Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. You're about to have a wonderful and inspirational time today for Spirit in Action. Our guest is Ali Horiat, and he's an amazing human being. Ali grew up in Dubai, had loads of education in Europe, eventually obtaining 3 master's degrees, made a huge fortune in Canada, then gave it all away to reboot his life, free from a wealth addiction and also free to direct his energy to the true betterment of the world. Ali created Compassive East, a mutual support organization of compassionate activists, and they're doing wonderful work. We had production help today from Andrew Jansen, and we have a full, uncut version of this program on northernspiritradio.org, including an invaluable 15 minutes on topics like the role of education, the riches of the Compassive East website, and the extra E at the end of the name, Compassive East. Right now, Ali Horiat joins us via Zoom from Dubai in the Middle East. Ali, it's wonderful to have you here today with me for Spirit in Action.
Thank you for having me. This is going to be an amazing show.
It's also amazing that we get to reach out across all the way from the USA Midwest to the Middle East. This isn't the first time I've interviewed someone in Dubai, but it's fairly rare for me to reach this far across the globe. Are you tired at the end of the day? I mean, for you, it's like 6:30 p.m., 7 o'clock in the evening.
No, because 90% of my team at Compassive East works out of Latin America and the West Coast, so LA area. And we have a few people in Quebec and Montreal, Canada, and New York, then London and Melbourne, Australia. So I don't really have a time zone that I live by in the zone that I'm in geographically. I live by my team's time zone, and everybody's kind of agreed to live by the West Coast time zone. So for me, I have conversations with people at 2 a.m. And when I travel, when I go back to London or when I go back to anywhere else that I am, you know, it just shifts to that time zone. So then it's just a few hours away instead of 11 hours away or 10 hours away or 12 hours away.
I have to admit that I'm torn in at least 2 directions while talking to you. Your personal story is so very inspiring, very gripping. And I also think that the work that Compassive East is doing is gripping. This program, Spirit in Action, is about people doing world healing work, and that's what's important to me. And as part of that, it's really important from my point of view to understand what motivates and enables people to do that kind of work. Because a lot of people think, no, I've got to do this to earn my daily bread or whatever's important, or that what's important is money or power or something. And yet people sometimes change their direction in lives majorly. You did that yourself. I'm going to start by talking about what Compassive East does as an organization, and then we're going to talk about what got you there, because that isn't where you started.
Not at all.
In 2016 or so. And the major change happened. So please describe for our listeners, for Spirit in Action, what Compassive East is.
Compassive East at its core is, imagine an octopus. And for people who don't know much about this animal, an octopus in that bulbous body and head of it has a big brain. And in its tentacles, let's just, you know, imagine an octopus, an orange octopus with 8 tentacles. In each tentacle, it has a little brain that manages that tentacle independently. What Compassive East is it's that octopus. We're all connected to each other in that big brain, but through our own little brains. But we're tentacles of that one. The idea came to me when I was in school, and for the first time, I had to read about Spinoza, a philosopher in the Netherlands. I learned that we're all interconnected. We're all part of one whole. And it really made sense to me. It resonated with me. Through my journey, I call it my awakening, my spiritual awakening. You know, all these pieces were coming together, but I couldn't realize that they were coming together. I couldn't observe and take them in that way. Because to me, at the time when I was learning about Spinoza, it was just, I need to write this essay. I need to pass so that I get my master's in philosophy. That's it. That's where it stopped. It wasn't really changing my life because I wasn't that interested in knowing what the purpose of all of this is. And it came 20 years later. So I carried all this weight with me, so to speak. 20 years later, all of this came into place with Compassive East. And I thought of, what do I want to do with my life? Compassive East began. It's about a movement, a social movement, where we all come together and we realize and we act upon what is best for the world and what is best for the future of our existence and what is best for our cooperation. And how do we reach that? And I tapped into the history of our civilization and I realized the way this works is through compassion. If we can learn to have compassion and love in our actions and prioritize this compassion in our actions, we really don't make the mistakes and don't make the capitalistic actions that we generally do in the world today. So, quick example, say we're in a shoe store trying to buy a pair of boots. You're trying to bargain for a better price. You're going to have your economic hat on and you're going to try to haggle for a better price. Now, imagine a lion walks into the store. You know, you're not going to use that same economic mind to make sense with the lion and ration why the lion shouldn't eat you. You're going to have a fight or flight kind of replacement, quick replacement in your modular mind. And this is going to essentially tell you, you need to find a hiding place really quick because fight is not an option anymore either. That's your rationale speaking. You're going to try to find flight. Now, if we take this to the core and prioritize compassion in a way that this module never leaves, then when we're bargaining with the store owner, we don't try to haggle and, you know, get the lowest price that we can because we think this store owner may be earning that difference in profit just to get by and feed their family. We think of a lot of things before we go in there. You know, we go into the supermarket. We don't buy everything that's on sale because, you know, it's half price now. Let me take it all. I need it. Other people will want it too. We take just enough. So this mentality kicks in. And then when the line shows up, we also think, okay, compassionately, what's the best option here? I mean, what is happening in nature here? Does this lion need to eat? Do I need to flee? And there's many different ways you can think about it compassionately. It may not be rational, but it'll be compassionate. So I thought, let's put compassion at the core of Compassive East. And I thought compassion is useless without action because I see compassion all over social media and talk everywhere today. Every other post is love and care and be kind and all these things that are really trending all the time. But then I look around and I see the world's not behaving that way. So I think to myself, what's compassion without action? It's meaningless to me. So I figured we need a word that describes the person who acts compassionately all the time. And I thought, Compassive East, because it's activist and compassion together. And when I say activist, I really mean the action that follows the compassion. I don't mean activism in its violent sense that it's known today, the protests and the rallies and all of those things. I really mean, if you thought compassionately about going to Walmart and you want to buy water, you look at the prices, you're going to pick up the cheapest water that's in plastic bottles. That is the economic mindset. Now, you throw compassion into it with activism. You say, well, I'm going to forego a few dollars and buy the bottled version or the version that's safer and better for the environment. And so you follow that through your activism and you're giving up a few dollars to do that. You don't have a few dollars to give up. That's fine. That's great. Because Compassive East is a community, assuming that this community is ready and built, there will be other people in there that will support that transition for the people who can't. In that community, holding each other. Eventually, that community will have enough people being able to make that transition compassionately that the supply side of the market starts responding and says, hey, plastic bottles are not selling. Walmart keeps sending them back. And, you know, we need to shift. That shift is done through that kind of activism. It's not done through posting on social media, Nestle's an awful company because, you know, it produces plastics. Don't buy it. Let's boycott Nestle. Nestle is only responding to our needs. If we tell Nestle we only want water and we show them we only buy water that's in glass or that's in a sustainable packaging, Nestle will produce bottles that's in sustainable packaging. But when we tell Nestle, we post this, but 5 minutes later, we're at the supermarket buying the plastic. Nestle listens to the dollars. It listens to the financial reports. It does not watch social media. So that's what Compassive East is about. And in every tentacle, we have a program, a social program that brings people together, forms this community. And the programs are really based out of data-driven science and expression, the arts, because I also believe through my own research and history that every change, every movement, every progress begins in the arts, begins in someone thinking about it, begins in someone drawing it out or ruminating over the concept. I mean, Leonardo da Vinci thought of the helicopter. He had it in his notes, but he didn't have the science. He didn't have the technology. He didn't know how to get fuel out and build the engine and everything else to get to that point. But he imagined flight. He said, you know, I can see birds fly. I can imagine flight. Let me see how I can put it together. It's that art that begins the thought process to later, you know, centuries later, here we are, helicopters, an everyday thing for many people.
So what are some of the more concrete things that Compass Feast does, the programs that you've done? By the way, I'm absolutely with you on the program. There's community and connection. The motivations that are underneath the compassion absolutely need to be there. Then it gets lived out in various ways.
That's exactly it. And I'll give you two examples of our programs so you can see the tangible ones and the ones that are built more through the arts. A good example of the tangible one. We have a carbon labeling program, which is one of the first in the world. Now imagine this is what the program's about. Right now, when you walk into Walmart and you pick up an item off the shelf, you know, tomato paste, you can flip it to its back and read all of the nutritional information. And it's very precise these days. You know, they give you things to the gram. If you ask somebody who lived in the 1940s or 30s, you know, when you went to pick up a can of tomato paste, what information did you get? And they said, oh, nothing, just, you know, the name of the company that or the farm or whatever that produced this can. That's about it. And so with innovation and with demand, because, you know, people got sick, some people were allergic to garlic or other things that were in the paste. And so, you know, to fix these issues in society, we advanced to nutritional labels. And now it's the law, you know, it's very well managed. We don't have that for carbon. We talk about environmentalism a lot. All these governments meet every year somewhere to discuss plans and how to fix this and, you know, how to get to point B safely. But the essence is not there. The education is not there. We don't teach it to our kids in school. We don't teach it at the university level, unless you're really specializing in that specific field. And we don't teaching it to the public. And I think it starts with somebody coming out and saying, okay, here's a label, just like your nutrition label. It's going to be just one line for now because we don't have that much information, but it's a start. And we're going to say this. Coca-Cola says, okay, we'll put your label on. Our can is 3 grams of carbon. Pepsi comes out and says, our can is 2.5 grams of carbon. Now, what are people going to do? They're going to buy Pepsi. What's that going to do to Coca-Cola? They're going to go back and say, R&D, you need to figure out a way to fix this 3 and make it 1.75, because 2.5, you know, that's not a good place to be. And so Coca-Cola is going to do that. And just like they did with pricing, I mean, everybody would like to sell their soft drinks at $20 a can, but they can't because they keep undercutting each other to a point where they can't undercut anymore, right? And that's just economics. You do the same with carbon. You reduce all of these corporations and all these factories and all these manufacturers to a point where they really cannot get better with their carbon ethics, so to speak, by providing the education to the consumer to be able to make that difference. So that's one program which is driven by the science, it's driven by data, it's driven by the laws of economics. I'm not fighting capitalism here. I don't like capitalism because I think there is a time and place for everything. And right now, we did really well from, you know, the late 1700s to the early 1900s in developing and growing with capitalism and innovation and all of that. But then somewhere along the line, the idea of the true idea of capitalism was to fund innovation so that the public can benefit from it. And then somehow it all got skewered to fund innovation for the person who innovates, and that's it. And so now we're in that position. So it becomes a dangerous system. We need to shift away from it. But this is just a way to play within that system to say, okay, if we're going to have to play within that system and there's no way to change it right now until apocalyptic future, then fine, I'll think of a way to play within the system. And this is one of my thoughts to play within the system. We're going to go after the competition and allow them to do that through teaching the consumer. So that's one, which is science-driven.
On the CompassFeast.com website, you have mentioned essays, little things that you've written here and there, some very short about collectivism. And I think that's what you're talking about now. I know that spirituality is important to you. it's an important element of where you're going. For me, the difference, one of the key differences between religion and spirituality, is whether you have community built in. That is to say, one can have any spiritual belief and not be part of a community. But when you're part of a religion, you thereby identifying with a group of people. Are you pro-religion, or it becomes a very touchy issue because so many religions try and brainwash people into walking their way and to carry with them a lot of baggage? And I think I saw mention on the site also that part of the big issue with religion is power. When someone gets power, they tend to use it in a way that's self-interested, not necessarily interested in all of the world, all of the people, animals, and plants. So it becomes a narrow focus of what we are. And I believe in the we that is universal. So anyway, religion, spirituality, your thoughts on that. You grew up as a Muslim. You had some Catholic instruction along the way. You've obviously broadened your view of where we is.
To answer that, let me first go to a definition to define certain parameters of this answer. Religion and organized religion are two different things to me. Organized religion is an industry, and you have shops in this industry. So the Vatican, you know, other places, these are just stores in an industry, in a capitalist industry. They're just there to make money. They're really not there for the greater good, so to speak, as you mentioned it, universal. And the reason I say that is not because, you know, they're not giving the charity or they're not helping. No, they do those things as part of their marketing mechanism. That's their marketing dollars that's playing. But I say it because if you ask the Vatican, there's a flood in Brazil and there's a lot of Catholic people there, and there's a flood in Israel and there's not that many Catholic people there. Where do your dollars go to? And it will go to Brazil. It won't go to Israel. That tells me that you're not following the Jesus mentality, because that wasn't part of the deal when Jesus spoke. So organized religion to me is flawed. It's a system of power. It's a system of capitalism. It's inherently flawed because you're building a hierarchy upon which the motto of this hierarchy is to grow. And growth is power in this sense. So I don't like that. But do I like religion? Of course I love religion, because a bunch of people are coming together with the right ideas, which you can find in all religions at their core. Islam, the Abrahamic religions, I mean, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, they all stem from the same source. They all have the same message within them. I've lived through all three. I've had best friends who are Jewish and grew up with Christians, and, you know, my family's Muslim. So I've seen all three very well. When I look at them and I say, hey, you know, a lot of things are identical and they were kind of born out of the same systems. And then you go to even further ones that are different, like Hinduism, for example, or Jainism. And you see, it's not that different. The core of it is compassion. The core of it is love. The core of it is to hold each other in a community and the animals in that community as well. It's not just people. Religion is not just, you know, Mark and Ali sitting in a church together trying to help each other through their problems. No, it's also caring about the cows that are outside who may get washed away in a tsunami. That's part of religion. So I love religion in that way, but without the organized bit in it.
I watched the video of you being interviewed by Mustafa Al-Khatib, and I found it very interesting. It presents a lot of information that you don't normally get from your other interviews, because you get to use the language of Islam, which adds a whole lot to the whole discussion. Again, when you say religion is good, but organized religion is problematic, I totally get that. From my point of view, a big issue is the definition of we. And the more liberal you are is frequently measured by how big your circle of we is. If we're only concerned about the good of Sunni Muslims, if we're only concerned about Presbyterians, if we're only concerned about some small subsection of the people who identify with our particular flavor of religion, then we've got problems. So how did you get to the point where your definition of we is worldwide? How did you get there? Because that's where there's many forces wanting to limit us to a little sense of we.
Categorization is key. They want us to stay within our categories, within our cubicles. And that is key for the power of organized religion. So referencing the interview that you're talking about, I was in Iraq and I met somebody from the network where Mustafa works in. We started talking because at that point, I had just written a book. And in that book, there was a lot of mention of Ali ibn Abi Talib, who is a key figure in Islam, regardless of what sect you're from. The histories are different because the sects have different histories, just like many sects, historical sects anywhere in the world. But nevertheless, very influential figure in Islam and in the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad's life personally as well. And so I brought in some of his wise words into my book. They had read this and they said, wow, this is really contextually perfect for us because we're Shiite here and we would really enjoy this kind of conversation. And when I grew up at home, I grew up in a family that was split between kind of very secular Sunni side of a family and very religious Shiites side of the family. And so I got to experience both. And I went to school as a Sunni, so to speak, where I learned religion. And like I said, when I went to boarding school as well, I learned Catholicism. I woke up, rosary and prayers and everything was part of the school. So that was there as well. I learned that the essence of the religion is the we is everybody. And when you look at the historical stories, a lot of people don't know these. That same Ali that I'm talking about, Ali ibn Abi Talib, the prophet's cousin, he was partners with a Jewish person in a business. It's a fact. It's in the history. There was a date farm. There were partners in there, and it's in the history. But they don't teach you that in school. They don't teach you the relationships. They don't teach you the relationships of the prophet with Jewish people who lived in the community. They walked around Mecca and the whole holy places and around the Kaaba and everything else. They were not banned from working in the city or anything else. When Islam came in, it brought freedom and the slaves were freed and everybody was equated, so to speak. It wasn't on the basis of religion. You didn't have to be a Muslim to be free. You could choose to become Muslim because you appreciated what this new religion is bringing to the world, but you didn't have to. You could have remained in your own belief system. And that's why you don't have stories within the communities where Islam ruled, kind of like the Inquisition. You see, the different histories there, different parallels. But this is all lost now. Today, Islam is a very edgy religion with, terrorism attached to it and all these other conversations, negative implementations attached to it, because this is the organized part of religion. This is the state terrorism harboring. This is a lot of other conversations that come into play that is not religious, has nothing to do with you praying five times a day or fasting during Ramadan or being charitable or, any of these conversations. It has to do with power. So that's where I kind of split from organized religion. That's where I said, no, this can't be correct. I'm getting educated here. I'm on my third master's degree. I see all this insight and I got all this information in front of me. And I've traveled the world. I've been to over 150 countries. And when I say I've been there, not layover at the airport, I've actually stayed there for at least a week in any of them. And I've seen the cultures and I've seen the people. And it's not like that. That's not what religion's about anywhere in the world. So why this problem we have? And then when I went to Canada for university, I went to a school that had a substantial amount of Jewish people in that school. And I became friends with them because, we had to do work together in groups and everything else. And I slowly realized, hey, these are normal, just like me. They're just people like me. But though when I grew up in Dubai, there was no hate, there was none of that, which really helped in allowing me to open up. But we didn't have Jewish people in the country. It was before the Abraham Accords. So, there was no Israelis, no Jewish people openly in the country. Even if you're a Jewish person doing business in Dubai or something, it was very hush-hush that you were Jewish. So I'd never had interaction, so to speak, with the Jewish community. Here I am in Toronto learning. And then I go to their homes and I see their grandmas who are very Orthodox and living by the religion. And I'm like, hey, my grandma does the same things, but in a different word, halal kosher. And then I ask, how do you do this? And it's almost identically the same way. And so I start realizing, hey, there is no difference other than marketing. It's kind of like Nike and Adidas. You want to buy a pair of running shoes to the average runner who's, running, jogging 2 miles, 3 miles a day. It really is not going to make a huge difference in your physical capacity and outcome, whether you buy this pair of runners or that pair of runners. Remember, professional athletes in the 70s used to wear Converse to play basketball. Okay. These people can still kick anybody's butt at basketball in their Converse. average person, right? And even some NBA players, maybe. But the thing is, we buy into, just like you said, the advertising buys us into it. You know, we see the celebrity runner wearing these new Nikes and these flashy colors, and we're like, I have to run in those. If I don't run in those, no, it's just not happening. And so we compartmentalize ourselves, right, into that space. And we say, oh yeah, I prefer Nike. Why do you prefer Nike? You're not even a doctor. You don't even know which one is made for your foot type. So these are the problems I found in religion. And I learned to let go. I said, no, this can't be. Because if I stay here, I'm staying within a delusion that's problematic. So my we is not only the entire human race, but it's every living being, every life that has breath, that is animated, that has function, that has purpose in this world, is part of the we in Compassive East.
I'm right there with you. And folks, we are speaking with Ali Horiat today for Spirit in Action. His website is compassivefeast.com, but you can always find links to all of my guests of the last 18 and a half years on my website, northernspiritradio.org, and Ali's website, by the way, compassivefeast is a .com. And again, that's on northernspiritradio.org, where I also hope that when you come by our website, you'll post a comment, give us your feedback, give us direction. We need all of the community to be adding to our work. It's not just me, Mark Helpsmeet, sitting here. It's not just Ali Horiat doing the work. It's when we work together and collectively as community that we have true power and make a big difference in this world. So please leave your comments, your suggestions, your help at our website, northernspiritradio.org, runs on your donations. We don't take money from corporations or government. And part of that is because we want to serve our listeners. We are also served in a partnership with community radio stations across the United States. Some 35 stations carry our programs, and they need your help. They work on a shoestring, and you can help tie that shoestring in a beautiful bow with your help. Please do help out that way. Ali Horiat is here. We're going to talk a lot more about Compassive East, compassiveeast.com, the website. I'm tempted, Ali, to just let you just keep talking because you always have valuable and important and vital things to say. One of the things I'm not sure if people have picked up on clearly yet is that you worked in finance for a number of years. Evidently, you made some big money, maybe up to a billion. I don't know. How big were you at that time?
A little over 100 million US.
100 million. And then you gave away and you walked away from that. You gave it away and you lived without money for a while. You still have the riches of your education, your knowledge, your friendships, your connections in that way. But you gave away that money. Who did you give it to? And why didn't you give it to compassivefeast.com?
First of all, I look at it this way. I detoxed. I let go of my addiction. I was working and my life was work. I was really excited and fascinated about making money. And I really wanted to be on that Forbes list. Really desperately was working towards. And it was happening. I mean, I was, you know, when you make your first million, it is so difficult to get there. And then from 1 million to 5 million happens in a blink. And then from 5 to 20 happens, you know, really quickly. You know, money just starts rolling in because you have the capacity, you have the power to bully with your money. And so that really is the main concept. And you start winning more. You get to a point, you know, for people to really understand this, because I appreciate that people with over $5 million net worth in the whole world is less than 0.1% of the entire human population, believe it or not. So, you know, when you speak with people or to people, and you talk about anything over $1 million, you're limiting people understanding that experience to a very, very minute fraction of the world's population. And they're scattered. So to give context, look at any professional sports. You bring in a billionaire who can purchase players. Even if they're not winning the trophy, chances are they're in the semifinals and finals every season. It's just the way it is. Money bullies. And so that's how you become very, very wealthy. You make the right decisions because you can also afford to make the wrong decisions and walk away from them without too much trouble. Whereas the poor person can't. They're putting all their eggs in one basket to get to the next stage. So I reached that level really quickly. When I decided to let go, it wasn't because I thought about Compassive East and made up my mind and walked away with a plan and a purpose. I walked away when I realized that I was becoming extremely wealthy to the point that there was nothing I wanted or could have wanted that I couldn't get with my money. But none of it was making me happy. It was just acquisition. It was just purchase. And it was just momentary. I would buy something. And for just that split moment, even exotic cars, it was just really the moment of the purchase and that first drive. And then it was over. And the depreciation was way too much for that, you know, financially. I could have just rented that same car and had the same excitement. But then I realized this is where it hit me. I went to Vegas once and I went on a racetrack. And, you know, you can rent exotic cars. And they had the same car I had in the same color. And I sat in that car and I didn't feel any pride. And then I realized what gets you is the ownership. When they tell you, you have purchased this, you own it. And that becomes the addiction. That pleasure of the ownership, that pleasure of, you know, it's mine kind of deal. Whereas, you know, it's everybody's and we get to share it together. And so I realized I have this addiction. I have this problem. I need to let it go. And I tried fixing it. I stopped working for a while and I took a vacation and it was a few months and it was a very lavish vacation up to my standards then. I was, you know, sitting poolside at different five-star resorts. And I realized every day more and more that there wasn't a way for me to repurpose the funds because the funds were the problem. The funds were what kept me as that hierarchical figure. I'm rich. I call the shots. This is how it's done. And this is the way life goes. I needed to bring myself to a level where I can have dialogue and I can have that we conversation as opposed to me. And I know what's good for you and I will do that for you as well. But me first. And that is organized religion. And that is any other structure of any corporation, essentially. It's me first as the boss or the shareholder or the stakeholder. And then it trickles down to the labor force. And so I said, I need to let go. I need to either go back to my work. And, you know, this was a fun vacation. I go back, I start over again, and I forget about all of this. I give it up. I say, this is it, Allie. You're just going to evolve to that perfect new human, which is the capitalist human, right? No feelings. You give away that baggage. You shed your compassion. You shed your heart. You shed your emotions. You shed all of it because that's what keeps getting you in trouble. You keep having these emotional moments about the wrong that you're doing, the immorality that you're bringing to the world. Either that, or you shed the excess on this side, which is the money, and you build your compassion and you become the archaic human. You become the Jesus Christ model and you accept everything that comes with it. Over a short period of time, I decided to do that. I gave my funds away anonymously, all of it, one shot. And some people found out and they tried to publish the stories. And I had to actually fight to keep the story shut because they were able to trace how this happened. And I don't want to publicize it simply because I don't want the story to stop there. When the papers and when media get the story, they tend to stick to that story. You become your history up to that story of giving away the money. You don't become what happened afterwards because afterwards you don't have money. It doesn't matter anymore. He's living in some farm somewhere doing whatever he's doing. Nobody cares. We only cared until this point. And to keep people saying, hey, we want to know why. We want to know what you're doing today. We want to know what is happening. I kept that anonymous. And I promised I would. And even my home, I lived in a really, really huge home. It's now a rehab center. So it goes with my own concept of detoxing from addictions. And I had an addiction to money and I detoxed from it. Over 5 years, right up until the pandemic, 3 years of it was right up until the pandemic. Over the first 3 years, I kept thinking, going back to the beginning of the conversation we had together of how I can make this impact of bringing compassion to the world. And I came up with Compassive East over a period of time where I had no money. And when I say I had no money, I actually saw compassion in ways that I still am shocked when I see it because I slept in a train station one night. I was having a conversation with the homeless person who was there. I said, I've never seen you here. I said, I'm not from around here. I'm just traveling through. And he said, oh, where are you from? And so he got excited about the conversation. And I told him some stories and he was enjoying it. And then he said, oh, do you have money? And I said, sorry, if I had money, I wouldn't be sleeping here. And he said, no, I don't mean it that way. And I'm not asking you for money. I said, if you don't have money, let's go get food. And I said, but I don't have money. And he said, no, there's a kitchen that we go to and they give us food. And I said, okay. He's like, do you have ID? Because they were, I said, no, I don't. He said, well, let's go see what happens. He went there and he went to bat for me saying that I'm traveling and I'm homeless and I'm actually staying with him. And they knew him there. And he got me food. And it's food that he could have kept for himself because I wasn't there. I was standing a little further away. And he was telling them that, you know, he knows somebody with him. And so, and this is the story. And he comes back with the food and gives it to me. And he's like, "Hey, if you're still hungry, you can have some of mine because I can eat here tomorrow again." And at that moment, I was like, this person is actually giving me his net worth. The only thing he has is the clothes he's wearing and this bag of food. And he's telling me that I can dip into his bag of food. In all of my wealth, I have never told anybody to dip into my bag of food. It's always been, I can help you with this much, or I could donate this much, or let me see what the tax purposes are, and I'll give the donation based on that. But it's never been, what do you need? Let me satisfy what you need to my community. And I realized from people there that there's a lot more that you can bring to the table with compassion. And over those experiences, over 3 years of traveling place to place, kind of homeless, semi-homeless, I was able to build upon everything that I was doing essentially. That's where Compassive Peace came to life, through these experiences. And then I realized, hey, maybe I shouldn't have given the money away. But then I came back to the fact that had I not given the money away, I would never have been here. So it had to happen, kind of like my education had to happen. And to understand how I have all this education, it's not because I really wanted to in the beginning. It was because a lot of people from the Middle East will understand this. I went and I did my economics degree first in Canada. And I was supposed to come back and get married and settle down, you know, semi-arranged marriage and all of that, and work for my dad and whatnot. I had seen too much of the West and the freedoms and, you know, the growth that I can have and the change that I can have in my life. And at that young age, because I started school when I was 16, university, and at that young of an age, I graduated my first degree when I was 19. I was not ready to come back. So I turned around and I told my family, "Hey, I'm doing another degree." And they were so proud of me. They're like, "Okay, fine, son, go do another degree." And then I said, "Hey, I'm doing my master's now." "Okay, great." "And now I'm doing another master's." "So lovely. Now I'm doing a postgraduate." "That's great, son." And I kind of like escaped it in a way until I was old enough for them not to bother me. That was why I went and got educated. But then 20 years later, all that education, all those experiences, all those travels, all that wealth that went into forming me became purposeful. And in the purpose of it all, I reached a point where I understood why I've had all of the privileges that I've had in the ways that I've had it specifically.
One of the things that I did along my way, I had three different majors when I was at university. I graduated, and some of them are fairly lucrative. Math, science, all that kind of thing are a big part of my background. So I graduated from college and I said, okay, I could go to work for IBM. I'm a computer programmer. I could do that. But I also said, no, that's going to put me in a certain box, in a certain direction. I don't want to have someone else driving. So that's when I made the decision to go in the Peace Corps. And I think it was the wisest decision I made in my life, because I went and lived in a village without running water or electricity for 2 years in West Africa. I got to see, and one of the things I learned, and I think you pointed this out, the person who was helping you in the train station, the most generous people I've met have been in the poorest countries of the world. They give not only from what they have, but they'll even give you the shirt off their backs, quite literally. And that taught me a lot about how, even though I love the Midwest, where I live in the United States, the people here are wonderful in many ways. There's still a depth of generosity that they don't have that much of the world has. And I think you explored that well with Compassive Feast.
Yes. And it goes to your example. Can you share, because this is really important to Compassive Peace work. You told me you were away for 2 years and you were teaching French and doing other work and stuff like that. Tell me how you learned that compassion of people like that over there in groups of people, and what it meant to you. Because that is the essence of Compassive Peace, coming from another person who is not per se Compassive Peace, right? But you are, because you understand that. So tell us.
I was training the incoming Peace Corps volunteers a year or two into my time there in Africa, because I was fairly high level, both technically and in French. So the incoming Peace Corps volunteers, one of the things that they get struck by when they arrived in Togo was the number of beggars sitting around, which we just don't see commonly in the United States. And a number of these incoming volunteers had negative reactions to it. Beggars always holding out their hands saying, "Donne-moi 25 francs." And there was one time I was traveling with a group of Peace Corps volunteers. We were going to a restaurant. As we were going in, there was a 9-year-old kid there holding out his hand saying, "Donne-moi 25 francs." And one of the guys with the Peace Corps group said, "Oh, that's so annoying. I'll get him when we come out of the restaurant." So the 9-year-old kid steps up to us again when we're leaving, and before he can say or do anything, the new Peace Corps volunteer holds out his hand and says, "Donne-moi 25 francs." And the kid reaches in his pocket, pulls it out, and puts it in his hand. And I tell you, the Peace Corps volunteer's mind was completely blown. He didn't know that what this really is that, hey, I need something. Please share with me. He didn't understand that. And it totally changes the view on the world to understand that this is not just that someone wants to take your money. This is, I need something to be shared from your riches. Very different education for the world.
Yes, very different education. I saw a lot of that.
I tend to think that having lots of money is a bad thing. It takes a lot of strength and clarity to not turn that into something like, I'm good, I've got it, you have to come to me. If you kiss the ring, then I'll give you something. And I'm still wondering how big compassivist is. When someone becomes a compassivista, what does this involve? Are there people who get together regularly? How do you do the community aspect of compassivist?
Like I told you, most of the team is based in West Coast, USA. A lot of the groups that we have grown into and become part of essentially are Mexican, Latin American, Colombian, that region, and people in LA from those backgrounds. The thing about Compassivist is there's no hierarchy. There is no control. Compassivist USA, which is a 501c3 in the USA, is actually licensed and under the name of one of the members. Compassivist Brazil, the person in charge there is Juliana, the lawyer that I told you about. Compassivist Europe is under somebody else's name. And Compassivist in the UK is myself and two other people. So none of the spaces are designed. Again, Compassivist Publishing's director, who has the final say on everything that happens there, is not me. Is Joanna, and she's in Australia. So I've designed it in a way that doesn't start and end with Ali Horiat. I've designed it in a way that when Ali Horiat passes away, whether he's successful in making extreme change and gets a gunshot to the head, which is, that's when you know you did well, or if he dies of old age, whichever it may be, there will be continuity. And that's one of the problems that I saw and I learned in history that you should never do. You should never build on your own brand, on your own self as a brand, because the continuity dies with you. Essentially, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, that's what happened. The power of the progress that he could have brought further during those years kind of fizzled. People just scattered and, little mini groups formed from there, and everybody wanted power and everybody wanted to fill that void. It happens there. It happens in corporations. It even happens in cartels. All of a sudden, there's a war in your city. What's happening? One of the bosses died, and now, three of the other little bosses are killing each other to see who gets control. And so everybody's stuck in the middle of this. Everybody may get a stray bullet, right? And the worst of the examples or the best of them, when the person dies, that void becomes a trouble zone. So I've created Compassivist in a way that there is no void to fill ever. Everybody comes in with their own power. Now, how do we grow? People join, they follow Compassivist on social, start interacting, or they send us an email. They say, "Hey, we want to be a part of this. We want to make some changes. I have an idea." Somebody did come to us and say, "I love what you guys are doing. I have an idea. I help this place do such and such, and I really want to grow it. And I want to use this network to be able to bring more to the table here." We love the idea. It's a really genuine idea. It's a noble idea. Let's do it. We get involved with them. They bring their resources. We add our resources and we kind of let it grow. Even in the publishing side, I have a person, his name's Robert Kinget. Everybody should look this person up because it brings you a new perspective on life. K-I-N-G-E-T-T. Robert's an author with Compassivist and he has a book with Compassivist. And essentially, Robert's blind. When he was born, due to lack of oxygen and some complications and whatnot, paralysis, he grew up with a lot of abuse because his mom, who was raising him, was alcoholic, and he went through a lot. And in school, he went through a lot of bullying and problems as well. And with all of his disabilities and issues, it was really hard. You would think he would grow up very traumatized and just not be able to handle his life. But he moved in with his grandparents, did well for himself growing up. He looked at the positive side of life. He ended up getting a job at the Chicago Tribune, and he really is the embodiment of hope and joy and gratitude in the world. He gives so much and he's so alive and he's just so happy. I begged him, I said, you need to give me your book because don't self-publish it. When you self-publish it, you're telling your story, but when you put it here, you're telling a whole community, a whole world what you're doing. And we're standing by that. We're standing by your example. We're standing by the way you're bringing your story to light. He's a gamer and he's gay. And I was fascinated. I said, you're blind. You have all these disabilities and problems and issues that you deal with on a daily basis. How do you play, Nintendo? How do you do that? That was something for me. So I learned things that I'd never known in my life through this person. And I learned his dating life as a gay person in that capacity. And it's an eye-opener because these things you would never know. It's just way too extreme to kind of think of all these things put together in a sense. The fact that he smiles, the fact that he's happy, the fact that he does not let anything stop him, and the fact that his whole concept is to bring that education and bring that compassion and say, it's okay. Things happen in life. It's okay. I don't blame the doctors for making a mistake. I don't blame my mom for being the way she was. I don't blame the kids for bullying me. It happened. It's fine. I can make the world a better place by educating the next generation or other people to do better by people like me who are going to come into the world over the next decades. And that mentality of not having hate, of not wanting revenge, of not feeling sorry for yourself, all those things, it just takes me to a place of these are angels amongst us. And that's what Compassivista is about, is bringing those voices together. All of the people who are really those people. And there's a lot of them. You would think, oh, I don't know anybody who's that compassionate, who's that loving. Almost everybody is like that. Two problems. One is, the spaces have not been formally created for these people to be able to come together. These days, we go to our churches, we go to our mosques, we go to our synagogues because that's where we feel we can come together and be compassionate. We sing at them, we do whatever we do at them, we worship together. But we're under this umbrella that controls us, which I call organized religion. It's not an umbrella that necessarily is growing us as a community to the best capacity of our community. Whereas we need a formalized place where we can come together and say, this is humanity, this is love, this is everybody inclusive, this is everybody accepting, this is everybody loving each other. And surprisingly, I'm getting a ton of calls, even very important people in the discourse. I mean, I had a person who got in touch when I'm talking about Israel with the conflict happening right now. A lot of them are reaching out and saying, this mentality you have, we need to kind of build on it and pull it in and try to do something here. And some of those people, they've been interviewed by Christiane Amanpour on CNN. And I said to them, wait, you're coming here for what? You have access to everything media-wise right now. Like, yes, but we need the type of people who understand what we're saying, who are not in the power struggle, who are not in that academic void that, their conversations are meaningless. So I'm beginning to understand people are appreciating this space. And once it grows to the space that it will be very difficult to get people to find flaws, want to leave, or anything like that, because essentially the whole idea of the space and all its artistic arms is to bring people together and nurture compassion and love. How could you go wrong?
Well, how could you go wrong? Compassionate activist, Compassivist, the website compassivist.com. It's linked on nordenspiritradio.org. You still didn't tell me about why there's an E at the end of Compassivist.
This is a very quick and easy one. So when I came up with the word Compassivist, I thought activist, compassion, it should be Compassivist with a T at the end. That's the last letter. It stops there. Then I looked at the word and I wasn't happy because when I read it in French or in Arabic or other languages, I say, compassion is part of my feminine world. And so I thought compassivist comes from motherly nurture. It comes from compassion. I say compassivist is that. It's compassion. It's meant to bring people together, to love, to share, to raise, to lift, to support, to do all those beautiful things that are lacking in the world today. In this social evolution that we're going through towards this cutthroat capitalist human, we're giving up our mothers. That's what we're doing, in a sense. And I want to bring that back. So I put that E in there so that every compassivist that remembers themselves and says, I am a compassivist, and wears that badge proudly, remembers that within that, there is compassion as a mother. And you're always a mother to the earth, to the other animals, to the environment, to the biodiversity, to every human that crosses your path, to every animal that crosses your path that you can help instead of kick or kill. So that E is the most powerful letter in the entire name. And we need to preserve that.
And that website again is compassivist.com. The links on northernspiritradio.org. Ali Horiat has been with us here today for Spirit in Action. 13 books by Ali is the last count I heard via the website. You'll find more essays by him and you'll connect with, and you can be part of this compassionate activism in the world if you go to compassivist.com. Ali, I feel like we've only scratched the surface. I love what's beneath the surface as well. And I'm so grateful that you joined me here today for Spirit in Action.
Thank you for having me. This was a lovely conversation. And I love that the more I speak with people, the more I connect. You know, you are a compassivist, whether you like it or not. It's not about joining. You know, it's not necessarily about signing a document or anything. You are a compassivist because of the experiences you've had and because of the way you live. All I'm doing is trying to bring that to people's attention, that you have that built in you as a human, and you should nurture that, and you should empower that part of you, and you should raise it. To that point, we are working on certain things that you'll hear about soon that will bring it to the public in a much more powerful fashion, in a much more tangible fashion that people can really interact with, and not just a digital space or social media, because I don't really love those kind of ideas either. I'm more of a person who needs to experience tangibly. And I feel a lot of people, especially when it comes to love, you need to be able to experience that. You need to be able to feel that more than just seeing it on a website. So I appreciate the website. I appreciate my team doing all the social media and all of that, because I never had social media in my life until Compassivist. But, you know, we're going to have that tangible experience. So keep an eye out for that.
And I just want to give a little bit of thanks to Mary Stringer for connecting us up via podcastbookers.com. That's her website. Very helpful.
Yes. And she's a musician.
Oh, she's a musician.
Yeah. Mary makes music and she's a musician. And I love that when I connected with them, you know, here, the universe just keeps sending me these beautiful souls, right? I connect with Mary and she's a musician, and I listen to her play her guitar and her song. It's just so beautiful. And I told her too, I said, look, you're a compassivist, because she's not just doing this as work. You know, that's the most important part of compassivist. It's the relationships we build and the passion that we do what we do with is way beyond this transactional nature of things. When I first spoke with Mary and Nicole on her team, they said, this is what it'll cost to kind of get this flowing for you. And I said, sure, you know, let's do the month, see how it goes. And when we started working together, I realized, you know, Mary's interested. She's speaking with me. She's understanding compassivist. She's trying to connect me to places, not just to tick the numbers off. You know, if they came to me and said, well, we're going to give you 20 bags of food in return for $10. And they just give me first 20 bag that comes there. No, they said, what kind of food do you like? And I said, well, you know, I really like Thai food. And I'm like, okay, let's try to get a more Thai food in those bags, right? That is the relationship there. So I love them for really bringing people like yourself to me, as opposed to bringing a podcast about Bitcoin and saying, hey, Ali, you know, you were an early investor. What happened there? And they're not doing that. They're actually bringing the compassivists out of the woodwork and saying, Ali, this is the places you need to speak on. So thank you very much, Mary. I hope you're listening.
And again, folks, website northernspiritradio.org will get you to compassivist.com. Thanks so much, Ali.
Thank you.
The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song. strong. We will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.